Okay, good to see everyone. Appreciate you being here. Lesson 7 tonight, you see what we're covering. Almost 3 chapters there in 2 Kings, and then we've also got some information to talk about there in 2 Chronicles 21. Won't leave this up long, but we're just kind of keeping track of the different kings that have reigned so far in each of the kingdoms. We're talking about a period of history now, of course, known as the Divided Kingdom. Israel was one time united under one king. But now you've got the southern kingdom of Judah, and you've got the northern kingdom of Israel. And you see the ones that have served in Judah so far. We very recently talked about Jehoshaphat, right? Was Jehoshaphat a good king? Yeah, he was an excellent king. We talked some last week about those alliances that he had made that he was faulted for. So he made some mistakes along the way, but he served the Lord, right? And it would seem that he was always willing to repent and seek forgiveness from God. So an excellent king, but unfortunately, he's going to be followed by his son Jehoram, who is going to be a really bad king. We'll talk some about him in just a minute. Now, the confusing part is, right now, we've got a Jehoram reigning in Judah and a Jehoram reigning in Israel, right? They're not the same person. We've got two different men named Jehoram. Jehoram, who's reigning in Israel over here on the right-hand side, is the son of Ahab. And, of course, you remember how wicked Ahab was. Jehoram in Judah, he's not a son of Ahab, but he's related to Ahab, right? How is he related to it? He's married to Ahab's daughter, right? He married Athaliah, Ahab's daughter. And so you can see where that would have some influence, and we'll talk some more about that here in just a moment. We were introduced some to Jehoram of Israel last week, right? You remember that although he continued the worship of the golden calves and all that, at least he tried to stop the worship of Baal, right? He cut down that altar and all of that. And so at least, you know, we can commend him for that tonight. But tonight we'll focus a little bit more on Jehoram in Judah. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and shut this off. And what I want to do is kind of slow down the pace a little bit this week. Instead of going through all the details of each account, I'm going to just kind of read selected portions. And I need you to be engaged tonight, okay? I need you to help me kind of fill in some of the blanks, maybe talk about some of the lessons that we can learn. But let's start in 2 Chronicles 21. We said we were going to talk some about Jehoram of Judah for a few minutes at least. And so that's where I want us to begin. In 2 Chronicles 21, obviously the whole chapter talks about him, but I want us to read the latter part of this chapter. 2 Chronicles 21, beginning in verse 16. Moreover, the Lord stirred up against Jehoram the spirit of the Philistines and the Arabians who were near the Ethiopians. And they came up into Judah and invaded it, and carried away all the possessions that were found in the king's house, and also his sons and wives, so that there was not a son left to him, except Jehoahaz, the youngest of his sons. After all this, the Lord struck him in his intestines with an incurable disease. And of course, instead of him dying right away, what do we learn in verse 19? Then it happened in the course of time, after the end of 2 years, that his intestines came out because of his sickness. So he died in severe pain. And by the way, if that makes you a little uncomfortable to read that, that's okay. It's supposed to be. And his people made no burning for him like the burning for his fathers. He was 32 years old when he became king. He reigned in Jerusalem 8 years. And how about this? And to no one's sorrow departed. However, they buried him in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the kings. Imagine me preaching a funeral for someone, and you know, you're starting with just the basics. You know, so-and-so was born on, you know, let's say October the 1st, 1945, and he passed away on September the 1st, 2020, and he passed away to no one's sorrow. I think there might be a little gasp in the audience. I mean, that's a horrible obituary, isn't it? No one seemed to be upset. So, my question is, kind of twofold question, why did the Lord punish Jehoram, and why was no one upset when he died? He killed his brothers, right? What do you suppose? I don't think we're going too far off the rails here to infer something here, but why would he kill his brothers? That's right. These are possible rivals to the throne, right? So let's kind of get rid of the competition, as it were. What else do we learn about it? Remember, I'll just kind of lead into the next part of this. Remember Jehoshaphat, it's not that he didn't have any wars at all, but generally speaking, what was Jehoshaphat's relationship with the nations around him? We talked about some of the honor and respect that they had for him, right? And for much of his reign, there was pretty much peace there, right? Was that the case with Jehoram? No, not at all. And what else? Now, we talked about his marriage to Ahab's daughter. And we remember how bad Ahab was. So did that have any effect on him? There's something really unique pointed out about Jehoram. Now, some of these other kings had their problems, but it says that Jehoram walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, right? He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. You know, we've talked about all those kings of Israel, you know, that we had up on the chart just a minute ago. All of them were evil, right? We talked about how they walked after the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Well, now, in Judah, Jehoram's doing the same thing. And the text seems to indicate that this marriage had a lot to do with it. Verse 6, he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, just as the house of Ahab had done, for he had the daughter of Ahab as a wife. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord. Now, Jehoram given any kind of warning about what was going to happen to him? Got a letter from somebody, right? Who did he get a letter from? Got a letter from Elijah. Now, if my understanding of the chronology here is correct, Elijah has already been taken up into heaven in a whirlwind. Knowing way I know to reconcile that is it may have taken a while for this letter to get there. You know, I don't know exactly how all that unfolded, but he's warned about what's going to happen. Some bad things are going to happen to your wives, to your children, and he was specifically told, you will have a sickness of your intestines. Now, he wasn't real specific exactly about what would happen to his wives and children, but we just read that, right? Now, the brothers have been eliminated, right? And now the children have been taken away except for whom? The youngest one, Jehoahaz. Now, why is that so significant that the Holy Spirit would tell us here that we have this one son that's left? Why is that so significant? Yeah, it keeps the lineage intact. Remember back, all the way back in 2 Samuel 7, God promised David, King David, that the line would continue in his name, right? And the one who is going to come, ultimately, Jesus the Christ, would come from that line, right? And so what happens to that big promise of Jesus coming through the line of David if there are no more descendants of David left? You see why God has a stake in making sure that that line is preserved? Now, we don't know all the details here. We don't know really any of them as far as how, you know, Jehoahaz was spared in all of this. But certainly that's a very significant detail.
Well, we see in verse 19 that the Lord would not destroy Judah for the sake of his servant David.
Right.
That's one of the reasons why I guess he didn't bring vengeance on the bad things that were happening.
Yeah, right. All right, well, let's move into this. Let's go back now to 2 Kings 6. Let's back up a little bit and let's go through some of these other accounts now that we've kind of talked about Jehoram a little bit. 2 Kings 6, We've got that first account there in verses 1 through 7 about this iron axe head. Okay? I know you've already read this, know the details, but let's just read a little bit of this. In chapter 6, beginning with verse 5, "But as one was cutting down a tree, the iron axe head fell into the water. And he cried out and said, 'Alas, Master, for it was borrowed.'" Now, is that commendable on his part? Yeah, I mean, it's not the most significant detail of this account by any means, but the fact that he was bothered that, you know, he's lost this, you know, this axe head that, or this axe that he had borrowed, at least the head of it's gone now. "So the man of God said, 'Where did it fall?' And he showed him the place. So he cut off a stick and threw it in there. And he made the iron float. Now, if the very same thing were to happen to me, you know, I'm out chopping some wood near some water. My axe head comes off and falls in the water. Do you think I could throw a stick out there and it would float to the top?" So whose power is at work here? God's power. I was just thinking the other day that so many of these stories we've been reading about Elijah and then Elisha, all of these miracles. If I had to kind of sum up the theme of all of this, you know, and I know this doesn't cover every aspect of it, but what's the song that we teach our children? "My God is so big, so strong and so mighty, there's nothing my God cannot do." Think about all the ways that God has shown His power, especially through these two prophets. Jim? He sure could have, right? Yeah, he did. Right. It comes to the top. But Right. But just think about the last part of verse 6. "And he made the iron float." Okay? That's not what iron is supposed to do, right? You throw some iron, any kind of, you know, iron substance out in the water is going to sink to the bottom, right? Certainly a remarkable miracle. But just thinking about this in a broader way, and I want to try to, not that we're going to go back and name all of them, but how does this demonstrate that God is Lord of heaven and earth? Now, that's an expression that's used throughout Scripture, you know, Lord of heaven and earth. And I take it by that, it means He has control over everything. How does this demonstrate that?
Well, He has power over the physical things that
happen on earth. Absolutely. And why would He have power over what we would call the laws of nature? Why would He have power over those? Yeah, He created them in the first place, right? I mean, think about the bad water. You know, earlier they threw some salt in there and made it just fine, right? We've seen Him cause it not to rain for 3 years and 6 months. So we've seen His power over nature, right? And so we've seen abundant evidence that He is Lord of heaven and earth. All right, this next section from verses 8 through 23, and we'll just call this Elisha leads the Syrians into a trap. I think y'all know what I'm talking about there. We'll clear some of that up if we don't here in just a moment. In chapter 6, let me skip down to verse 13 and read a few verses, and then we'll kind of fill in some of the blanks here. Chapter 6 and verse 13. "So he said, 'Go and see,'" the king says this, "'Go and see where he is,'" that is, where Elisha is, "'that I may send and get him.' And it was told him, saying, 'Surely he is in Dothan.' Therefore he sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city." Well, they sure want Elisha bad, don't they? It's a lot of effort to go to capture one man. Of course, the servant would be with him. "And when the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, 'Alas, my master, what shall we do?'" All right, so my question is, why are Elisha and his servant in such a predicament? Why is all this effort being spent by the king of Syria to capture Elisha?
Syria probably got a spy in the midst, but we stole one spy from the Lord.
Yeah, Jim? That's right. You know, the Syrian king, he would get with his advisors and say, all right, we're going to set up camp in such and such a place, right? And I think the whole idea is we'll catch them by surprise. And every time they tried to do that, the Israelites were on to it, right? They knew exactly what was going on. And as Chad indicated, you know, the king was upset. He said, is there somebody, you know, in my midst that's got something in for me? In other words, is somebody spying? Is somebody revealing to the enemy what's going on here? And finally, somebody told him, there in verse 12, Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. So wherever the king was, whatever plans he was hatching, Elisha was on to. Now, did Elisha have some innate ability? Was he some kind of mentalist? Of course not. Again, this was through the power of God, right? That he was able to know. And so he would just tell them what was going on. So that's why they're after Elisha. All right, so the servant is upset. Tells his master, look, we're surrounded here. We're in trouble. So what did Elisha tell the servant to encourage him? That's right. Great statement there in verse 16. Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Now, does that still apply? I know we're not in this city of Dothan here, and we're not surrounded by an army, but does this still apply to us in whatever situation we're facing? All right, finish this statement from Romans 8 and verse 31. If God is for us, who can be against us? If we've got God on our side, we've got more than sufficient resources, right? And if you think about it, in the very next verse, Elisha prayed, said, Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Yeah, I don't know, Russ. I do know in terms of application to us. I think about Ephesians 6 that talks about how we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but we wrestle against principalities and powers, the spiritual host of wickedness. I know that's talking about the bad guys, right? But are there good hosts on our side? Absolutely. Absolutely. Remember when Satan came before God? There in Job chapter 1, and God, you know, was saying, have you considered my servant Job and all that stuff? Who else was present in that meeting? They're described there as the sons of God. I believe he's talking there about angels. And there are other scattered references in the Old Testament and New Testament to the host of heaven. And so we have God and his host on our side, right? And so that's going to always be the case. Those who are with us, and ultimately God has more power than any of these spiritual hosts of wickedness. Jim? Well, sure, sure. We can't depend on that if we're going to live any way that we want to. Yeah, absolutely. You have to be in the right relationship with him. That is for sure. All right, so let's go down to verse 20. So it was, when they had come to Samaria, that Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see. And the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and there they were, inside Samaria. Now, Samaria is the capital of Israel. Remember, this is the Syrian army. And now, all of a sudden, they're right there in the middle of enemy territory, right? So, last we read, this army was surrounding the city of Dothan, and now they're right there in the middle of Samaria. How in the world did they get there? Yeah, God struck them blind. In fact, Elisha prayed for the Lord to do that, right? And that's exactly what he did. And so Elisha went out there, and what did he tell them? The This is not the right place, right? You know, the man that you're looking for is not here. And so he leads them right into the middle of Samaria, right into this trap, right? And so the king then says what? I mean, we've got them trapped. We've got the Syrian army trapped right inside our city right here. So what does the king suggest, or what does he ask might be done? Now, let's go ahead and wipe them out. Let's go ahead and kill them. And Elisha's response is what? Feed them with bread and water and let them return to their master. And so that's exactly what he does, right? And so here's a situation where Elisha and his servant are just in seemingly an impossible situation, right? And yet, God works His great power and brings them certainly out of that situation. So, again, sometimes we just... And I was just thinking the other day, I was talking about the psalm, "My God is so big and so strong." So many of these stories we've been reading about make for great stories, period. They make for great children's stories. If you're looking for some stories to tell your children, what we've been studying here for the last 3, 4, 5 weeks, these are great. These are great. I mean, there's a lot of drama in them, excitement in them. You know, you're trying to impress upon your children the greatness of God, right? I believe these stories serve to do that. Chad, you have a comment? No, and of course that, a little caveat on that, we see later that they eventually do, but I guess that means at least for a period of time they didn't. They don't just never ever come back again, but it certainly puts the quietus on them for a while there. Alright, so let's look at this next section. Starting in chapter 6 and verse 24, and going all the way through the end of chapter 7, we've got this siege of Samaria. All right, now, what is a siege? Right. It's not open warfare. They've got the place surrounded. Nobody can come in. Nobody can come out. As Russ said, the food supply is cut off, and so it's basically just starving them to death, right? So that's what's going on here in this section we're about to consider. So let's read chapter 6, beginning with verse 26. Now, we said earlier that the reading we did about Jehoram was uncomfortable. This is going to be about uncomfortable times 100. 6:26. Then as the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried out to him, saying, "Help, my lord, O king." And he said, "If the Lord does not help you, where can I find help for you? From the threshing floor or from the wine press?" Then the king said to her, "What is troubling you?" And she answered, "This woman said to me, 'Give your son, that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow.' So we boiled my son and ate him. And I said to her on the next day, 'Give your son that we may eat him.' But she has hidden her son." So, do you think the siege has gotten bad? That's about as desperate as people can get right there, right? Jim? Right. That may be true. I don't see anything that would lock that down necessarily, but you may be right. You may be right about that. I certainly won't. I'm not going to say you're wrong, but I'm not going to say you're right either. Yeah. But I will tell you, and you may recall this yourself, but back before the children of Israel, we're going way back in time now, right? Before the children of Israel went into the promised land. You remember, right before they went into the promised land, Moses preached to them. And some of that preaching was warning them about, okay, here are some things that are going to happen to you if you don't serve the Lord. And this very situation that's described here was one of the things that he said would happen. And so it's happening just like Moses had said way back then. And so, really, the fault lies with the king and the people for not serving the Lord faithfully. That's why all of this is going on. This is why things are so bad. All right, so the king is upset. And so he says, well, I've brought this on my people. I am so sorry. Is that what he says? Not quite. On whom does he place the blame? Whose head does he want? He wants Elisha's head, right? Verse 31, God do so to me and more also if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on him today. Now, who is he ultimately blaming? God. In fact, look at the end of verse 33, the latter half of verse 33. Surely this calamity, this is the king speaking, is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer? What does that imply? Maybe that Elisha had been telling the king. Why should I wait on the king any longer? Yeah, the Lord's going to take care of this. Now, I feel certain there was a message of repentance connected with that, right? You know, but that, it sounds like Elisha had been telling them to look to the Lord and trust in Him for deliverance from this, right? And again, that would involve repentance on their part. But he's not going to wait any longer, right? He's going to take care of business. In fact, talking about Elisha being able to detect things, does he know the messenger is on the way to get him? Now, he's talking to the elders of the city, and what does he say? Do you see how this son of a murderer has sent someone to take away my head? He knew he was coming before he even came. He wasn't privy to the conversation, right? He didn't know this had been said. But again, I think about statements made in the New Testament, like in Revelation 2 and verse 23, the Lord searches the minds and hearts. You know, so He knows what we're saying. He knows what we're thinking. The story later that we'll talk about Haziel, he knew what Haziel was going to do even before he did it, right? He knew he was evil. He knew the plans he was hatching. And so, bottom line for us, are we ever going to think, do, plan anything without the Lord's notice? The Lord knows it all, right? The Lord knows it all. And that's a sobering thought. But there's an encouragement in that too. I think about in the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus was teaching about prayer. What did He say? The Lord knows the things you have need of before you ask them. So there's an encouraging side to that as well. All right, so what announcement does Elisha make here at the beginning of chapter 7? You don't have to go into all the details, but what's the bottom line to what he says? Yeah, everything's going to be back to normal. This siege is going to end. Right now, we didn't go into this earlier, but even some of the most undesirable items, you know, are kind of been jacked up, you know, and now he says that, you know, the prices will be fine, everything's going to be back to normal. But one of the officers of the king was a little skeptical about that, and what did he have to say? What was his question? Kind of doubted the Lord being able to do that, right? If the Lord opened the windows of heaven, could he do this? Now, this is why it's important for all of us to always know a little history. And I'm talking especially about Bible history. Can you think of a time where that phrase was used? I'm thinking all the way back to the book of Genesis. Do you remember a time that the phrase, the windows of heaven were opened, was used in the book of Genesis? The flood. And that flood, I guess it caused a few problems here and there, right? Destroyed the world that was then standing with the flood. That's what God's able to do when He opens the windows of heaven, right? And so, you know, it's like, I just don't even know if you could even accomplish such. And so, what does Elisha tell him? You're going to see this, but you will not eat of it, right? You know, you're going to see what I've said. You're going to see that it comes true, but you won't be able to partake of any of this food that I'm talking to you about. You won't be able to, and we're going to see that come true in just a minute. All right, well, let's move along here. Let's go down to chapter 7 and verse 5. You've got these four leprous men. They've been sitting at the entrance of the gate. And they're thinking, okay, well, if we stay here, we're going to die. If we go into the city where the famine is going on, we're going to die. So why don't we just head out here to the Syrian camp? If they feed us, okay. If they don't, we were going to die anyway, right? So, you know, what's the harm? I think it's some pretty reasonable thinking on their part. But in verse 5, it says, they rose at twilight to go to the camp of the Syrians. And when they had come to the outskirts of the Syrian camp, to their surprise, no one was there. Now remember, a siege is going on. This army is supposed to have surrounded the city, and these leprous men go out there, and there's no one there. So how come no one was there? God scared them off. That's the bottom line. He goes on to explain the next couple of verses, right? The Lord caused the army of the Syrians to hear the noise of chariots and the noise of horses. They thought a great army was right on them, right? And so they just got out of there. Got out of there just as fast as they could. All right, so let's get down to verses 10 and 11. Now, you may, just to kind of fill in a little bit here, remember what the four leprous men did after that? They kind of helped themselves to some of the stuff in the tents, right? But then they got feeling bad, like, you know, look, this is a day of good news. You know, if we don't tell somebody, I'm afraid some kind of punishment's going to come on us. So they head back to the city, right, to tell what's happened. Verse 10, they went and called to the gatekeepers of the city and told them, saying, we went to the Syrian camp, and surprisingly, no one was there. Not a human sound. Only horses and donkeys tied, and the tents intact. And the gatekeepers called out, and they told it to the king's household inside. And so when the king heard that, he said, well, great, they're gone. Is that what he said? What was his reaction? He thought it was a trick, right? Look, I know these people are hungry. At some point, somebody's going to make a mad dash for it out here, right? To try to get some food, or maybe a bunch of them or whatever, and we're going to head out there, and they're going to end up capturing us and then work their way into the city, right? So somebody suggested, okay, well, let's send some folks out there and kind of verify this information, right? And so that's what they did. And what did they find? Just like the leprous men. I mean, they followed the road that the Syrians took. They followed it all the way to Jordan. What did they see along the road? You know, all their stuff. I mean, like I said, they couldn't get out of there fast enough. All right, now look at verse 16. Then the people went out and plundered the tents of the Syrians. So a sea of fine flour was sold for a shekel, and two seas of barley for a shekel, according to the word of the Lord. According to exactly the statement that Elisha had made earlier. Now, think about this now. This horrible siege is going on, right? We've had two women agree to eat each other's son, although one did renege on the deal. That's how desperate things are going to come. Now, when Elisha made his announcement from the Lord, it wasn't like, if you'll give me about 2 weeks, or if you'll give me about a month, then all this will be over. What did he say? Tomorrow about this time. And that's exactly what happened, right? He was able to bring this to an end. Now, what about that man who questioned the Lord's ability earlier? What happened to him? He got trampled in the gate, right? And that's how what Elisha said came true, right? You will see this happen, but you won't get to eat of it. The people were so in a rush to get some food. Here was this man standing by the gate. They were in such a rush to get the food, they trampled this man. So again, it happened just according to the word of the Lord. Look, I know this is basic, but over and over again, we've been seeing that phrase, right? Let it sink in every time. According to the word of the Lord. When the Lord speaks something, right? It's going to come true. it's going to come true. We can take it to the bank. And so, knowing that's the case, whenever the Lord gives some command to us, then we need to always observe it, right? We need to take the word of the Lord very seriously. All right, chapter 8. There in verses 1 through 6, we've got this land that's restored to this woman. This is that same Shunammite woman that we read about earlier in our studies. But in chapter 8, let's look at verses 3 and 4. It came to pass at the end of 7 years that the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, that she went to make an appeal to the king for her house and for her land. Then the king talked with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, "Tell me, please, all the great things, Elisha has done." All right, so, and I know we could read on from here, but, so you've got two conversations taking place, right? This woman comes in. She's making an appeal to the king. "Look, I've been away. I would like my land and my house restored to me." At the same time, Gehazi is talking to the king about the great things Elisha has done. What is Gehazi talking about the moment the woman comes in with her son? What's he talking about? Talking about her. Talking about the time that she had raised this woman's son from the dead. Now, what a coincidence, right? Is it a coincidence? I don't think it's a coincidence. And the thing about it is, there's no miracle that takes place here. This is God's providence working, right? To make sure that all of this kind of comes together, right? That it collides. I love verse 5. This is one of my favorite verses in the whole section. "Now it happened, as he was telling the king how he had restored the dead to life, that there was the woman whose son he had restored to life, appealing to the king for her house and for her land. And Gehazi said, 'My lord, O king, this is the woman, and this is her son, whom Elisha restored to life.'" The one I just got through telling you about, this is the one. She's standing right before you right now. And so the king was very gracious to her, right? Did he restore her land and her house? Now what did he do above and beyond that? Yeah. Right. Give her all the proceeds of the field from the day that she left the land until now. All right, this last section, verses 7 through 15. Elisha meets with Hazael, the servant of the king of Assyria. All right, so let's read verses 9 through 11. "So Hazael went to meet him and took a present with him of every good thing of Damascus, 40 camel loads. And he came and stood before him," that is, before Elisha, "and said, 'Your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you, saying, shall I recover from this disease?'" And that's commendable on Ben-Hadad's part, right? I mean, it's the king of a foreign nation, king of Syria. But he sent him to ask of the Lord what's going to happen. "And Elisha said to him, 'Go say to him, you shall certainly recover. However, the Lord has shown me that he will really die.' Then he set his countenance in a stare until he was ashamed, and the man of God wept." So, what was Elisha weeping about? Look at verse 12. "Hazael said, 'Why is my Lord weeping?' He answered, 'Because I know the evil that you will do to the children of Israel. Their strongholds you will set on fire, their young men you will kill with the sword, and you will dash their children and rip open their women with child.'" And Hazael like, who am I to do things like that? Elisha answered, "The Lord has shown me that you will become king over Syria." All right, so help me out here. We seem like we've got contradictory statements, right? Elisha said, "Go tell the king that he's going to recover. But the Lord has shown me that he will surely die." Is that a little bit of a head scratcher? So how did that work out? Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah. What did Hazael do to Ben-Hadad? What did he do to it? Verse 15, but it happened on the next day that he took a thick cloth and dipped it in water and spread it over his face so that he died. And Hazael reigned in his place. Why do you think Elisha was staring a hole through Hazael? It says it stared intently at him. Why do you think he was staring at him? And perhaps we don't really know for sure, but what does Elisha know about Hazael? He knows how bad of a man he's going to be. He knows he's going to be king. And he knows the destruction that he's going to cause. It's almost like somebody used the expression last night, it's almost like he's looking into his soul. I don't know, maybe trying to elicit some kind of response from him. I don't know. But again, I will admit we've had some morbid stories tonight, right? Had some morbid stories. But again, just keep thinking about, you know, all the different ways the Lord shows His power. And even with someone like Hazael, as evil as he was, you think the Lord can still work that into a good thing? Yeah. I think we'll see some of that later on. All right, we're out of time, so we'll bring it to a close.